Just to introduce myself for some of you who do not know me, I am Steve Redden. I am one of the elders here. I'm a teaching elder here at Caversham Community Church. Been here for a long time, as you can tell by the grey hair, grey beard and all that sort of information. And this morning we're going to be talking about the resurrection. Now the resurrection is an apologetic topic that has the high place. It is also a theological topic, but as an apologetic topic, it holds the highest place. If you think of apologetics like building a castle, you have foundations, you may even have a dungeon or dungeons, storerooms, wine rooms, all that, and you build up. And as you build up, you build something right at the top, gives you a clear view of a surrounding landscape. You can see the night sky, and talking of the night sky, Lindsay rang me last night. He's up there in Naseby with his family wishing me luck, and he's taken some photos of the night sky up in Naseby. I'm interested to see what he got. But you have the highest part of the castle. The highest part of the apologetics castle is the resurrection. It's the pride of place. It is what's up there. But it holds the highest place because of all that is built below it. All that comes, that looks better than there. All that comes before it. There is the foundational elements. And these are, and I'm not going to really be dealing with these, but these are some of what those are. That truth is real and knowable. We haven't talked about that, but truth is real. It is knowable. The old adage, there is no absolute truth. That if that statement's true, then it's false. There is truth and it is knowable. That God exists, that's something we've talked about. We've had a couple of Sundays on that. That God does exist. There's a good arguments for that. That the works of God, miracles, are possible. That Jesus did live and die. That the New Testament letters, and specifically the Gospels, were written either by eyewitnesses or those closely associated with eyewitnesses. Just a little bit of an explanation here. I'm firmly committed to the inerrancy of Scripture. I am firmly committed to that. But for proving the resurrection, you don't need to prove the inerrancy of Scripture. You just need to take them as eyewitness accounts, reliable eyewitness accounts. That's all you need to do. Our case this morning for building on the resurrection is five minimal facts. I only need five. There's a lot of other details, but you don't need them all. There's just five. You can count them on one hand. Jesus died on the cross. Fact number one. The tomb is empty. Fact number two. There are eyewitness accounts. Number three. The arch enemy Paul's conversion. You must explain that one. The conversion of Jesus' brothers, James and Jude. That's not an easy one to explain. So with those five minimum facts, you can actually show that the resurrection is reasonable to believe. You may not convince someone, but it is. You can build a case that it is reasonable to believe in the resurrection. And again, I say, this is built upon all the other work that you do in apologetics. So the resurrection is the high point of the castle. And all of the rest follows. And when you get to that high point, you are able to build a really good case. So let's just look briefly at those. Now, actually, I'm quite impressed because I'm probably in about 4 minutes, I've actually given you the argument for the proof of the resurrection. I could probably go and sit down now and we could have early morning tea. But as the old expression, and my apologies for this one, given in the church, but the devil is in the details. You need to know the details. So the first one, Jesus died upon the cross. Jesus died upon the cross. This is a process. This is not just a single event, like if someone walked in here, held a gun to my head this morning and said, deny the resurrection, and I say no, and bang, I'm dead. This is a process that could go on for days. And my apologies here, I'm going to say some things that are fairly brutal for any of the younger audience. My apologies, but it needs to be described. I say it is process because it is more than complex than simply nailing someone to the cross. Those who make the claim that Jesus did not die upon the cross basically know nothing of the procedure. It doesn't start when the person is laid on the cross and nailed to it. It starts hours before. By the whipping. This was preceded every, under the Roman execution process, this was preceded every crucifixion. They would take the condemned man or woman, tie him to a pole, and then they would whip him. But it wasn't simply just a whip. The Jews would whip with just a leather strap. And they could only whip 39. They were, under the Jewish law, they were only allowed to whip 40 times, not one more. So they whipped 39, just in case the guy counting ran out of fingers. He lost a finger somewhere and made a mistake. So they didn't want to break the law, so they only whipped 39 times. But the Romans had no such law. They had no such provision. They could whip a guy 100 times, 200 times, 1,000 times if they so wanted. Their whips were also a number of straps, and in the straps they would tie little bits of metal, little bits of bone. And the guy who would whip was trained in this art of whipping, so that the strap would fall across the back of the person, the rest would come around, and the bone and the metal would tear at the skin. And as the whipping continued, it would tear at the underlying muscle. And then eventually you'd have the internal organs getting exposed. It was not that uncommon for someone who was enduring this whipping to actually die through blood loss. Then the condemned man would carry the crossbeam out. We've got someone up on the roof, have we? Then the man would carry the crossbeam out to the place of crucifixion. They left the poles there, and the man would carry just the crossbeam. And this was, you know, basically not a small piece of wood. It was a long piece of wood. It was very heavy. And it's not that uncommon for a man who's had this whipping to be carrying the crossbeam, not to be able to do so. And then they would haul someone in to carry it for him. And in Jesus' case, we're told that this was Simon from Cyrene, father of Rufus and Alexander, which is actually a very interesting comment in terms of the Gospels, because it indicates that the people who the author is writing to know Rufus and Alexander. So, basically, Simon and his family became Christians because of this. I must actually also say there is some who think that Jesus was whipped twice, not just once, but twice. He was whipped first time under orders of Pilate, because basically Pilate was trying to get him off, and he thought, well, if I get him whipped, then they will say, oh, that's enough. But they didn't, and he was handed back to the guards, and he may have been whipped a second time as well. When a person is nailed to the cross, the nails go through the wrist and through the ankles. Then the cross beam is hauled up now and attached to the cross of the beam. And the person's hanging there, their arms outstretched. To breathe, you've got to pull yourself up on the nails in your hands. If you're down, your head goes down into your chest, it's very difficult to breathe. A person actually dies of suffocation upon the cross. And it's this seesaw process of pulling up on the nails in your wrists and pushing yourself up on the nails of the hands and then letting yourself down on the nail in your ankles. And you're doing the seesaw process constantly. But just imagine for a moment the person on the cross. They have all the whip marks on their back. And when they're pulling themselves up, they're rubbing themselves on those whip marks. And eventually, people could live for days. It's not uncommon for people to live a few days. But it's not that uncommon that people died in one day. It's not that uncommon. But the person pulls themselves up, and as over a period of time, they start getting cramps in their arms, cramps in their legs. They're struggling to breathe, struggling to pull themselves up. Each time they pull themselves up, the pain in their arms, the cramp in their legs, the cramp in their arms, and they let themselves down. This was truly a horrible way to die. It truly was a horrible way to die. Under Roman law, no Roman citizen could be killed this way. In fact, when they do crucifixions of slaves and things like that, they were not to be done in places where Roman citizens could even see it. It was not to be seen by Roman citizens. So when we come to this end of this way of Jesus dying, how did the Roman guards know that Jesus was dead and not faking it? Because he was down and he was not pulling himself up on his arms. He wasn't pulling himself up. Yes, they'd pull down and you'd hear the ragged breath going out and in as he tried to suck breath in. But the person would die, the head down, and there is no attempt to pull themselves up. Then there was the spear thrust in his side that was proof positive that he had died. If Jesus cannot have risen from the dead if he had first not died on the cross. The next point of argument is that the tomb is empty. The tomb is empty. After Jesus had died, Joseph of Arimathea, a secret disciple who now made himself public, went and claimed the body along with Nicodemus, who we read about in John chapter 3. And they claimed the body, and Pilate is a little bit surprised that Jesus had died this early. But as I say, it's not that uncommon that someone died early. But he gets the centurion. So all this time's going on. The centurion comes. There's the messenger go gets the centurion. The centurion comes back, gives the message to Pilate. The centurion goes back and releases the body to they get the body down. All this period of time, the Roman guards are seeing that Jesus is not pulling himself up. They know he's dead. They know he's dead. But Joseph wants to pay Jesus a big honor. So he has his own tomb. He's created his own tomb in Jerusalem. He's from the town of Arimathea, and I'm not sure if anyone knows where that is. I don't think anyone actually knows where that is. But he's got this new tomb dug into a little hill, basically, rock, and big stone comes across that, and we'll talk about that in a moment. And he's got this brand new tomb. He's not a young man. He's anticipating that in the next couple of years he's going to be dying. So he's got this brand new tomb for himself and he wants to die in this important city of Jerusalem, God's city of Jerusalem, and he wants to die there. And he and Nicodemus go and take the body and they take it to the tomb. And while at the tomb, they wrap Jesus in linen and pack spices in around the body. And it says in the gospel messages that the women were there as well. They were probably helping in this process at the tomb. This proves basically, in a sense, no one expected Jesus to rise from the dead. If you're expecting him to rise from the dead, why wrap him up in linen and pack 25 pounds of spices around his body? You wouldn't. You're, okay, let's just leave him here and we'll stand watch. And after they did that, they rolled the tombstone down, very large stone, and that was rolled down for two reasons. One, to keep wild animals out. Wild animals are getting in and getting at the body. The other thing was to keep the smell in. We're talking the Middle East. And that's why they packed the spices around, was to cut down the smell. And then they rolled the tombstone down. But we have the testimony of the woman on the third day who came to see that they came with more spices to pack around the body. They didn't anticipate Jesus being raised from the dead. They didn't anticipate an empty tomb. Peter, James, and John came to the tomb, and the tomb was empty after 3 days. The tomb was empty after 3 days. If Jesus had not risen from the dead, he would still be lying in the tomb. The eyewitness testimony. Sorry, I've got a little bit of a cold. The eyewitness testimony. We don't believe in the resurrection simply because the tomb is empty. We don't believe it simply because the tomb is empty. The empty tomb would have been probably enough to convince them that God had done something with the body. By the way, Beverly, ask me about your question later. I've had it and I haven't talked to you the last two Sundays, so ask me about your question. It's relevant. pardon me. They could have believed that Jesus' body had been taken by God to explanation of the empty tomb. They could have believed that. No trouble whatsoever. In fact, anyone could have believed that. Even the Pharisees could have believed that if they wanted to. But that's not what convinced them. Why is this important that we recognize that it's not simply the empty tomb? It's important to recognize that the empty tomb wasn't enough to convince them of Jesus' resurrection. It was that they saw him again. It wasn't just an empty tomb. When Peter and John arrived at the tomb, we get an indication that John believed, but Peter didn't. I'm not sure altogether what Peter actually did believe. It was that they saw Jesus alive and well. He was not simply alive, but still suffering the effects of the whipping and the crucifixion, but that his wounds were healed. He was strong. He was alive. He was healthy. Anything less would never have convinced them that he was the Lord of life, raised from the dead. Everything that follows in the story of Christianity is based on this, that Jesus was raised from the dead. If these men and women were not convinced that Jesus was alive and they had actually seen him alive, healthy, well, they would have never done what they did. They give us their eyewitness testimony of seeing him, not an argument for why he should be considered alive, not a suspicion that he could have been alive, not a desire that he was alive, not even a belief based on Old Testament prophecy that he was alive, but on the very fact that they had seen him. They had seen him. Jesus cannot have risen from the dead if there are no eyewitnesses to confirm it. Fact number four, the conversion of Christianity's archenemy, Paul, or Saul as he was known. It's one thing to convince believers that someone has raised from the dead, and even then you've got to really be honest and say that the apostles and the woman and everyone else never expected him to rise from the dead. In fact, the only ones who actually did were the Pharisees. They went to Pilate and said, Pilate, we need a guard because this guy said he was raised again after the third day. We can see the apostles coming and stealing his body. And Pilate says, okay, you've got a guard. 16 men. We'll talk about that shortly. The Pharisees basically didn't believe. We're told these Roman guards actually came to them and said, look, here, we're giving you a report of everything that's happened. And they said, oh, okay, here's some money. You say that the apostles came and stole the body. You pass that message around. Here is evidence, testimony given to the Pharisees, and they didn't want to believe. I find that incredible. That given the evidence, they didn't want to believe. However, in fact, really, to be honest, they didn't deserve to see the risen Lord. They really didn't. However, there was one Pharisee who did. He was the arch enemy of Christianity, Saul. He was the one who led the charge against this new heresy. He was determined to stamp it out, because I think he was thinking in his mind, if we don't stamp this out now, God's punishment is going to come upon the nation. And I'm going to stop that here and now. Does it sound like someone familiar to you? How about Phineas in the book of Numbers? I think Numbers 25. There is this meeting with the nation around Israel, and there's intermarriage, starting a little bit of intermarriage and a little bit of sex, and this guy comes past the priest as they're praying for God's forgiveness and restoration and repentance. And this guy leads past a daughter of one of the high priests of the other religion. And Phineas picks up a spear, goes into the tent, and in the middle of there, as they're together, he drives the spear right through the two bodies and into the ground. I think Paul sees himself in that same light. I'm going to be the new Phineas. I'm going to stamp out this falsehood, this heresy, this disgusting aberration. I'm going to drive it out and stop God's judgment on the nation of Israel. And he does. He's killing a few people here. He's jailing others here. He's off to Antioch to arrest the Christians there because, hey, the Jews in Antioch are really buying into this one. So on the road, he is confronted. And in a couple of days, he's out convincing others of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. How do you explain that? How do you explain that? Paul's life before and after his conversion are significantly different. Significantly different. In one, he's willing to kill whoever stands against Judaism. Afterwards, he's willing to die for this false belief. And in fact, he does. In the mid-AD 60s. Paul's life before and after his conversion is significantly different. It wasn't just a small little change. Only minor differences. Nothing significant. It was a massive change. Within days, he is defending this new religion. And no one is able to refute him. You know, basically, if we hear every now and again of some significant scientist or philosopher who's become a Christian, usually what happens is this takes a period over a long period of time. Anthony Frew, for example, turned his back on atheism in his later stage. And part of that process was of debating a number of Christians and one particular. And they built up a friendship over a period of time. And Anthony Frew became an agnostic. He's got a book where he details it in the public library. There is almost certainly a God is the title of the book by Anthony Frew. But it's a period. This happens over years. This isn't overnight. This happens over years. But Paul is converted basically overnight. He goes from one extreme to the other extreme overnight. How can you explain that? Paul basically gives us the answer. I saw the risen Lord. I saw Jesus Christ. That's what convinced him. Right there. And he was never the same again. Seeing the risen Lord personally is the only reasonable explanation for why Paul was converted. Sorry, just looking for my notes. Oh, yeah. The importance of skeptical brothers. Now, you probably read the Gospels. You may remember at times that Jesus' family came to try and see him. And one particular point in Mark, they said because they thought he was mad. You think, hey, given all the miracles you're seeing, basically, wouldn't that convince you that he is who he is, who he says he is? But his family didn't believe. Mary did, but I think the family didn't. We know that he has four brothers that are named. He has a number of sisters who aren't named. But at one stage, they came to get him because they thought he was mad. In fact, I think that James probably thought that Jesus was dishonoring the family. That by what he was doing, he was bringing shame upon the family. And we never read, apart from Mary, of anyone of his family during his ministry who believed who he was. Not one. But we actually have two letters from two brothers in the New Testament. The book of Jude and the book of James. In the book of Acts, we read that of the pillars of the leadership of the church in Jerusalem, who's one of them? James's brother. Yep. What could go from believing my brother is a shame to the family, my brother is insane, and we need to lock him up in the room, you know, where they provide the jacket with the zip up the back, to where he is not only a believer, but he is one of the most important believers in the church in Jerusalem. Paul tells us in 15, and he appeared to James. I'm convinced actually there's a bit more behind that. I think he actually appeared to the brothers as well. But more importantly to James, there's an explanation of why James did. Given his brothers were skeptical, how do you explain that? Only that he saw the risen Lord Jesus Christ. It is the only reasonable explanation of what had happened. Jesus' resurrection is confirmed by those who do not accept his claims during his life and ministry. James does that. Arguments against the resurrection. And there are a number, and this is just three of them. He didn't die upon the cross, the tomb is not empty, and the disciples were wrong. The tomb's not empty. The tomb is not empty. The tomb is full, is the explanation. Well, actually, no. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead of myself. He did not die upon the cross. And this goes by a number of theories. The swoon theory was the old title of it. I think it goes under a different name now. He didn't die upon the cross, whatever way it was. But what's the evidence for the fact that Jesus died upon the cross? The whole crucifixion process is particularly nasty. The idea that he didn't swoon, but they could tell he was dead by the fact that he wasn't pulling his body up. And you suffocate. Let's just imagine for a moment that Jesus didn't actually die upon the cross. They pull him down from the cross. The guards can't tell that Jesus is alive. Nicodemus and Joseph, they wrap his body in linen, and as they wrap him in linen, they pack in the spices. And you mean to say that even then being put into a cold tomb at night? A hot tomb during the day, cold tomb at night, with the linen wrapped around, the packed spices, and he was able to breathe under this condition? I find that rather hard to believe. Then 3 days later, he's able to push over the stone, he's able to walk to where the disciples are, he is able to pick up food and eat, because basically what happens when you put a nail through your wrist, your hand goes into a claw. You're never able to use your hands properly ever again. Through his ankles, and he's walking, and he shows himself to the disciples as the Lord of life with the whip marks, the exposed muscle, the exposed internal organs that are still bleeding, because every time he moved, they would bleed, and they'd be incredibly painful. And he is able to show himself as Lord of life. I'm afraid that takes far more faith than it does to believe that he raised from the dead. I'm sorry, I don't care what you're thinking. That takes far more faith to believe that he could convince them that he was the Lord of life in that condition. There is a case of where three men were crucified, and someone appealed to the Roman governor to actually have them brought down. And the Roman governor immediately acceded to the request, had them pulled down, provided the best medical help that the Romans could provide. Of the three men, two of them died. The third was never ever the same again. Very, very few men who ever came down off a cross ever survived. In fact, I'm incredibly doubtful that anyone experiencing what was involved in the process of crucifixion, the whippings through to the nailing, would ever survive under medical conditions today. Marge might be able to tell us more on that one, but I'm convinced that basically even today, the majority of people who experienced crucifixion, if they were brought down, would still never survive. It was that brutal. So you've got to explain how Jesus could appear as the Lord of life to convince them that he had been risen from the dead. No, all the evidence points to the fact that Jesus died upon the cross. In fact, we have modern medical evidence. There's been a lot of work done on by doctors and pathologists on what Jesus experienced, and the spear thrust into his side, and they are utterly convinced that Jesus, or the whoever this person was, died on the cross. They're convinced of it. They say the spear thrust is medical proof positive that he died. He was dead. Only the conditions of death under that means provide those conditions. So Jesus died on the cross. Let's not dilly-dally around here. The simple fact is he died on the cross. The tomb's not empty. So you've got to think here for a moment basically what that means, that he's still lying in the tomb. But we can say Joseph and Nicodemus took him to the tomb. And we've got to think here for a moment that really, if the tomb's still full, then they went to the wrong tomb. You mean to say that Joseph didn't know which was his tomb? The woman were with them. It says they were there watching. In fact, I'm convinced they probably helped. They were there watching. They knew what the tomb was, and then 3 days later, they all went to the wrong tomb. the Pharisees appealed to a guard from Josephus, Pilate, I should say. And then they went to the wrong tomb. Now, you could imagine they possibly could, because they didn't have a clue which tomb was which. So when they got to the garden, they would find the garden. Okay, which is Joseph of Arimathea's tomb? And more than likely, Joseph and Nicodemus were there as well, still dealing, wrapping the body up. They made sure that they were guarding the right tomb, given the conditions on which they were required to be there. They would not just take it, you know, toss a coin. Oh, is this the right tomb? Let's toss a coin. Heads it is, tails is, oh, it's tails. Okay, let's go find another one. You know, basically they'd be convinced they're at the right tomb because they want to guard the right tomb. By the way, their lives would depend on it. After Jesus was raised from the dead, do you mean to tell me that, the woman went to the wrong tomb, Peter and John went to the wrong tomb, but you mean to tell me they're the only ones that went to the tomb? Would not the Pharisees have wanted to go and check it out for themselves? I'm sure they probably did. You mean to say they went to the wrong tomb? The other disciples would probably want to check it out. They went to the wrong tomb. Other people wanted to check it out. They went to the wrong tomb. Joseph dies a couple of years later. They take him, his body, and they go to the tomb and open the tomb up. Oh, there's a body here. It's Jesus' body. You mean to say everybody, including Joseph of Arimathea or the people who buried him, all went to the wrong tomb? We're not saying that the disciples or the woman went to the wrong tomb. You've got to say everybody went to the wrong tomb. Everybody. Hey, come on, let's not be stupid. That's absolutely a stupid idea, that everyone went to the wrong tomb. So basically we've got Jesus died upon the cross. He was laid in the tomb. People did go to the right tomb. 3 days later, the tomb is empty. The disciples were wrong about seeing Jesus. This one tries to take the evidence basically as is. It tries to deal with the evidence as is. And there's two sort of ideas here. One is that Jesus didn't actually die. We sort of partly dealt with that. And he appeared before them as the Lord of life. As we've basically showed, no, he died upon the tomb. He couldn't have shown himself as the Lord of life if he had just simply walked out of the tomb. But you have to explain why there is no body. Now, if you're a Pharisee and you wanted to disprove the resurrection, what would you do? Go to the tomb, open it up, take the body, put it on a cart, wheel it through Jerusalem, and we would know nothing of Christianity and Jesus today. They couldn't produce the body. They had to say to the guards, basically, tell a lie. Here's some money. We tell a lie that the disciples came and stole the body. And if the message gets back to Pilate, don't worry, we'll speak on your behalf. We'll speak on your behalf. But what's required here from that? The disciples came to steal the body? 11 fishermen, tax collectors, none of them were trained soldiers. Not one. The Roman guard was probably about 16 people, possibly 16 guards, a bit more. Battle-hardened, trained, merciless killers of death. And what you've got to explain is that 11 men took on 16 battle-hardened, trained men, overpowered them, didn't kill one. And that's crucial. They didn't kill one of them. These 11 men overpowered these battle-hardened troops and didn't kill one of them and stole the body. I say they didn't kill one of them because if they killed one of them, guess what Rome was going to do? Track them down, crucify all of them, and anyone else who got in the way. The Roman authorities would not have done nothing if they had killed one of those guards. So these 11 men had to overpower them and not kill any of them. Now, let's just take 11 men from here, me included. What's the chances of us, 11 of us, taking on 16 naval SEALs, or SAS, or SBS, or commandos, or Delta Force, or whoever you want to say? What's the chances of the 11 of us taking on 16 of those men and not just killing them, but overpowering them and not killing one of them and not dying one of us? There's a miracle right there. I find, no, that's rubbish. And what we find is as we're getting further and further into these things contradict the facts and becoming unbelievable. Well, here's another one. This one attempts to, again, try and keep in the facts. They hallucinated. They so wanted to see Jesus alive that they were willing to see whatever they wanted to see. Let's just think about what their testimony about what they tell us about themselves. They were cowards. When Jesus was arrested, what do? All but two of them, probably all 11 ran initially, then two of them returned, and one of them denied Jesus three times, even though he was told he was going to do it. He didn't believe it, and he did. They were in hiding in the upper room. They were afraid of the authorities. They didn't believe Jesus was going to rise from the dead. And you mean to say, in spite of the fact that they didn't believe he was going to rise from the dead, they saw a hallucination of him rising from the dead, of his risen. That's getting a little bit hard to believe. We actually know a fair bit about hallucinations in this day and age. And ignoring mental illnesses, hallucinations come in two forms. Visual, auditorial. And usually it's not both. It's one or the other. But what do we know about Jesus? He appeared to individuals at different times. Peter, James, others. He appealed to a group of 500 men, and that probably included the same number of women, husbands and wives, probably even some kids, you know, could even be bigger than that, but at least counted 500 men. He appeared to this. What we know about hallucinations is they're very singular. Just for a moment, young guy wakes up in the middle of the night, wakes his wife and says, "Dear, I'm having a fantastic dream. We're on the beaches of Hawaii, really enjoying ourselves. You've got to go back to sleep and join me in this dream." So the next morning he wakes up and he wakes his wife and says, "Was it fantastic?" She turns around and slaps his face. "What's that for?" He said, "You were with another woman." Dreams and hallucinations are very singular. You basically don't hallucinate the same thing. You don't. And you're usually under very extreme conditions when you do.